Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. During this half hour, at least the first of an hour, we're going to talk about some of the problems people have had with the diagnosis they've been given. We're going to talk with both an advocate for change and someone who offers alternatives to people who have been victimized. And then we're going to go to some open calls for you to have a chance to share in this forum. Let's begin by talking with someone who is, I believe, in Akron, Ohio. How are you today, Janet?
I'm fine. I'm in Canton, Ohio.
Canton, Ohio?
Yeah,
all right.
Better town.
Janet, tell us about your story and what happened with your daughter who was on Ritalin.
Oh, geez. Stephanie had started Ritalin in first grade. The typical approach, you know, the teacher says, you know, beginning of the school year, she's having problems.
Janet, I just want to interrupt. Are you on a regular phone? You sound a little muffled.
I'm on a cordless phone.
I need to get on a regular one.
Oh, okay.
Just switch over. Sorry, it's a little technical glitch there. All right. Just
all right. One. Okay.
Pick up a regular phone.
Okay. Is that better?
Much better. Thank you.
Okay, maybe it's my voice. I just got it back after about a laryngitis not too long ago. Anyhow, it's just, you know, the typical, you know, she's having problems, you know, in school, sitting still, or she's making noises or whatever. And she's like, maybe you should take her to go get tested. And so we go the route of the neurologist, the psychologist, the pediatrician, and, you know, the psychologist is the first one to see her, and he's like, well, she's kind of antsy, and she's, you know, easily distracted, you know, and he sends that information along with the teacher's observations on to the neurologist, who says, oh, well, you know, she can read good, and, you know, she caught the ball, and sends that over to the pediatrician, and they kind of all have their little brainstorm, I guess you can call it that, and decide that she should start Ritalin. And so she was on Ritalin, and she was on it for, you know, 5 years. She had been on it, you know, like I had said, 5 years. And, probably about December of 95, she brought home a progress report from school, and it said that she wasn't turning in her assignments, and she wasn't doing this or that, and her grades were going down. So I called her pediatrician's office, and I said, you know, Stephanie's having problems in school. What should we do from here? And she said, well, this was a nurse practitioner who told me, wait till after the first of the year, and, you know, after the Christmas holiday season is over, and increase her milligrams by 5 more in the morning. So, okay, well, the first day they were due to go back, it was a snow day. Snowed up to her knees. So there's no school. So on January 4th, then, they started back. And this was of 96. And she took the increased dosage by 5 more milligrams in the morning. She seemed really, really out of it. And I kept saying to her, because I would take her to school, and I kept saying, Steph, are you okay? Are you okay? And she's like, yeah, I'm okay. I'm like, are you sure? And she said, yeah. And I thought, well, all right. Well, I let her out kind of like in the middle of the road because snow, like I said, was up to her knees. It's terrible. And so I said, well, you have a good day, and I love you. And she's like, I love you too. And she goes in school, and, you know, that's pretty much that. And then I pick her up that afternoon when school gets out, and, you know, same stuff. She's hungry as all get out, and she's eating and doing her homework, and, you know, she seemed a lot better than what she had been that morning. Well, then that night, we had went out to look, like, for a minivan, because we always told her the summer she turned 12, we would go to Disney. So we get out, and we're, me and my husband and us, you know, and the three girls, We go out and we're looking for this minivan. It's snowing and snowing and snowing. It was relentless. And I thought, well, you know, we're really not seeing anything. We were all thirsty, so we stopped by and got some bottled water at the drive-thru and came home. And Stephanie filled hers up, stuck it in the fridge, went upstairs, and she was horsing around with her sisters. And, you know, and I'm like, okay, you guys, go to bed, go to bed. You got school tomorrow. Brush your teeth. And they brushed their teeth. You know, good night. I love you. I love you, too. Usual stuff. And, you know, nothing out of the ordinary. Everything seemed okay. Well, then, morning, January 5th, my husband goes in to wake her up for school. He already had the two younger girls up and, you know, hitting the showers. And he was going to wake up Steph so she'd get in the shower next. And I forget how it went. He just went in there, and she wasn't responding. And I remember he yelled over to me, you know, something's wrong with Steph. And I'm thinking, wonderful. She has a fever. She's burning up. Great. She's sick. So I get up out of bed and put on my robe, go over to her room. And just by looking at her, she wasn't looking very nice. And so I went downstairs, and I called 911 and told them to get, you know, medics to my house because I thought my daughter was dead. And I went upstairs, and she had been sleeping on her stomach. And I remember turning her over, must have been adrenaline. I turned her over and started doing CPR on her, and she was totally unresponsive. And at one point, I stopped and said to my husband, I said, she's dead. And I thought, no, no, I've got to do something. I can't just stand here. So I started doing CPR again. And then I heard the fire trucks pull up and went down and met them. And I said, you know, she's upstairs. And they went up and they didn't even touch her. They just looked at her and they said, oh, she's gone. So the coroner later determined she died from a cardiac arrhythmia due to biochemical and metabolic changes. I guess I have to say, figure that one out on your own. I've had to pretty much, he won't confirm nor will he deny that Ritalin caused her death. It's just nasty. It's so senseless. There's no sense to her dying like that. Senseless.
So you feel that your daughter died because of the Ritalin?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was increased the day before. She was a perfectly healthy child. It was increased the day before, and then the next day she's gone.
Have you done your homework to look at the biological activity that occurs at that dosage of Ritalin?
You know, I have a very good idea. I know it's been researched on her behalf for me by some legal personnel, and it is definitely, oh yeah, definitely at that level. It's always been too high. It's been too high of a dose for her size,
mm-hmm.
for her body weight.
Now, what about your other daughter? I understand you had a second daughter misdiagnosed as ADHD and actually had a brain tumor.
Oh yeah, yeah. Isn't that wonderful? I'll tell you, life is good. obviously when Stephanie died, we took Jenny off Ritalin because Jenny had been on it because she was hyper and running the halls or whatever. So Jenny's on it, okay. And so she's on it, and the day Steph died, we took Jenny off because we had no clue what happened to Steph. I mean, I let her find out, you know, 5 years almost, that I have a magic ball somewhere that tells me that I knew that's what happened, but I didn't. Anyhow, she was taken off, and she went back to school, and her ADHD was gone. It was amazing. Jenny's fine. She was going to sleep in school now. She wasn't running the hall. She was falling asleep. Well, that was cured by going to bed a half hour earlier. She was in second grade at the time. Anyhow, she started having, like, automotor seizures when she was on Ritalin. But at the time, we didn't know what they were. We didn't know what could have been causing them. We didn't know. I knew that Ritalin could cause psychosis, so I kind of thought in the back of my mind, maybe she's getting psychotic from this medicine. Well, then Stephanie had passed away, and we took Jenny off. However, the seizures continued for a few months. And then they stopped completely for over 2 years. And then one day, like in July of 98, she had two of them in one day. And she had been off Ritalin, I mean, you know, for 2.5 years. So, you know, we take her to the pediatrician, and I said, I don't want in the opinion of. I want factual information. Show it to me on a test, and we'll deal with it. What's going on in her head? And so she had ordered an EEG. My husband had taken her over to the local hospital, and they showed an abnormality behind her right ear. So then we had an MRI ordered. Well, it showed something, but they weren't sure what. So we were referred up to the Cleveland Clinic. They did another MRI, and they said it was a tumor. So we're like, oh, great. So at that point, we just wanted to watch and see if she's going to have any more seizures. And she didn't have any more. I think she had, like, maybe two in November of that year. Well, then in March of 99, I remember she was in dance class, and she hit her head on the wall. She wasn't used to dancing in that room. She had been sick. She probably shouldn't have been to dance that day. But she wanted to go to dance class, so I sent her, and she hit her head on the wall. And then she started having seizures a lot. So I approached Cleveland Clinic again. I said, listen, she's having more seizures. I don't want her taking medicine. I said, you know, let's do something. So they said, well, before surgery, she has to start medicine because she'll have some instability in her brain because of the surgery. So we put her on for like a month or two. She had to go up there for observation for like 4 days. And before she left, that was like in May of 99, before she left, we had her surgery scheduled for June of 99. And
what happened with the surgery?
She had a astrocytoma. It's a level one. It was a tumor in her right temporal lobe.
How is she doing now?
She is fine. She'll be 14 a week from today. She's 14
okay.
years old.
Do you feel that the Ritalin may have contributed to that tumor?
You know, I don't know. I really don't know. In my heart of hearts, I am not sure. I think it could have been in there for a while, the tumor, and I think her being on the Ritalin alerted us that there was a problem because the seizure started then. And so it, in a way, it may have been a positive thing. Or she could have had this tumor in her head for, you know, another 20 years because there was no symptoms.
Or, you don't know, it may have, Ritalin may have been a contributing factor to it.
Could have been. You know, it's just, you know,
well, but the idea is, the bottom line of all this is that, once again, we have children running considered a disease to which a drug is given as the cure.
And there is no disease.
Well, unless you want to make running in, you know,
yeah.
a disease.
Yeah.
All right.
Excuse me. You know, these are kids. What do you want from them? They're kids. You
well, the next time a school teacher wants to tell you something about your kids, why don't you tell them to go to hell?
Well, I do.
All right. Tell them all.
They know.
They're at the heart of this.
I know.
We wouldn't have this false, phony epidemic if it weren't for irresponsible, completely negligent, lacking in any human quality teachers who would like to see Manchurian candidates or Stepford children sitting in a class so it doesn't annoy them.
I know. Exactly. I do. In fact, they don't even approach me. They don't even approach me about any problem.
Well, thank God, because...
Yeah, because I'll tell you what. They've met their match.
Good. Well, stand up to them. Stand up to them. Stand up to their union. Stand up to all those people. I'm sick of them. I'm so sick of these scumbags.
I know.
Who have destroyed so many lives. This is a form of genocide. When you kill, when you can cause the death of innocents, when you destroy people's motivation, when you destroy what is uniquely individual in them, that is a form of child abuse.
Oh, yeah.
And I put it right at the heart of psychiatry, the pharmaceutical industry, the pediatric profession, the neurologists. But don't let off the school teachers. You wouldn't have it if school teachers had the decency and strength to stand up and say, hey, get real. There is no disease. These kids are just kids.
Oh, they won't do that because there's money for the schools coming in.
Of course, every kid that's diagnosed with ADHD, the school is subsidized.
Oh, absolutely. Yep, it's
money.
Yep, bottom line.
Well, thank God for homeschooling.
Yeah, I know. I've thought about that, you know, but then I'm
it's the best. Take the time. I know too many people who homeschool their kids, and the homeschooling has given them the information without stressing the child in a non-competitive environment, and it's given them an environment of encouragement to allow the child to develop at the child's pace and still make the standards, and almost universally those standards are higher without the stress or adverse reactions and not being stigmatized or used in some stupid experimental project.
I know. It's gone too far. When a kid can't be a kid anymore, then you got a major problem.
Well, blame it on the baby boomers. We're the only generation. My generation has been responsible for so much corruption of ethic and decency, and yet we were the one generation that was supposed to save it. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah, sure is.
Well, thank God for aging, because sooner or later, baby boomers won't be around, and there'll be another generation that hopefully will be able to make
some difference. Well, I can't imagine what that generation's going to be like, because they're all full of drugs.
Well, unfortunately, you may take two generations, one that is not the victim of the baby boomer generation, but there'll be enough survivors who are not fooled by the arrogance and the conceit of the parents that life is nothing more than a security issue to which all things are subjugated to.
I know. Well, you know, it's gotten to the point, you know, I've heard people say, oh, well, they said, you know, if I don't put my kid on this and, you know, human services are going to step in. Excuse me. See, that crap here ended in my house the day my daughter died. I will never be intimidated by anyone.
Well, but remember,
what is in best interest.
But remember, it took the death of your daughter to wake your conscience up.
I know, and you think the people that hear me can learn from this?
We don't learn from many things. Otherwise, we'd have changed the course of where we're at now.
You know, and that's sad. It really is.
The sad part.
Everyone thinks that it can't happen to me. No. Surprise.
Well, the one thing that does happen to people is circumstances they cannot address, will not accept, will ultimately affect them.
Right.
And we're looking at 15 million kids now being told that they have mental disorders.
That's crazy. You know, now wait a minute. I've heard that you can outgrow ADD. Excuse me, I've never heard of anyone outgrowing a disease. Can you outgrow cancer? I mean, come on. Give me a break. Diabetes, can you outgrow it? You can't. Hello, people. You're being duped, you understand? You have been had.
Yeah, but you know the pharmaceutical companies.
they're evil. They're evil.
Well, look at it this way. They're smart business people. Right? They're smart.
Yeah, they're smart, but they're evil as they come.
Well, you know, they're profitable, and they don't care about... George Soros was that last year interviewed on 60 Minutes, and it was a rather remarkable interview for his candor, and it shows you how much arrogance man has. He, when asked, did he care about the consequences of what he did in making his money to the people he makes it from, he said no. Now think of that. Now think of the doctor says it's of no consequence to me what therapy I give you because I'm not the one suffering from the consequence of the therapy. Or imagine a teacher who says, I have a particular mindset today, and if you don't act this way, I'm going to make sure that you're on a drug tomorrow. And if you don't take the drug, I'm going to have your parents challenged as unfit parents, and they'll suddenly be brought up on child abuse charges. And so sooner or later, you're going to act my way, or you're going to be in trouble. And so were your parents. Well, suddenly we have allowed people to terrorize our society.
I know. I have given my girls strict orders that they are never to speak to anyone while they are at school about anything that goes on in this house unless they have my permission first. And that's them getting me on the phone at that moment to say, Mom, can I talk to this person? And I've told the principals of their schools. And I will not stop at that, because what I do in my house is none of their business. My kids are not abused. They are not neglected. They are loved. Someone is with them every hour of the day when they are not at school. They are not left home alone. They have anything they want. I don't need to be told I'm not doing something for my kid, because I am. I'm there for them. I used to work, and then when Stephanie died, that stuff ended, because you know what? My kids need me more than I need a paycheck, because someday my kids are going to be gone. And what are they going to have? You know what I mean? I can work then, but until they are raised 18 and out of the house, or 25 and out of the house, I'm here with them because they are my children. They are my responsibility to make sure I'm here for them. And I'm going to be there for them. And that's all there is to it. They don't need to be talking to anyone in school. If someone down at Human Services has a problem with me, come to me. Come to me. Don't prey on my children.
Good for you, because the only way we stop this tyranny and child abuse is to face it and be honest with it.
You better bet.
Janet, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Barry.
Hi.
I'm Dr. Levin.
Yes. Well, I'm just about to introduce you.
Okay.
But you were introducing yourself. And you have a PhD?
Yes, I do.
And you're here to talk about... Want to turn your radio off, please?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
All right. Ravala Levin is here to talk about the challenge to electroconvulsive therapy. Now, we've been talking about Ritalin. Now we're going to shift gears because over 100,000 Americans minimally will get electroconvulsive therapy. Not all of them are getting it voluntarily. And I don't think people realize what it can do to them and what is the game afoot. Please give us your perspective.
Yeah, Gary, I want to tell you that I've been listening to you earlier, and I very much appreciate your approach in that you're interested in how the patient feels and not how society feels. When a patient comes into my office, I'm interested in the pain that they have. Do they have anxiety? Do they have guilt? Do they have shame? I am not interested in how society is disturbed by them. And so I care about what they're going to tell me about their pain. If somebody gets shock treatment, it's because somebody else is disturbed by their behavior. They don't care about their feelings, but the doctor is disturbed. You're not behaving appropriately, you know, as if you didn't say thank you when you were given something. Or if you're talking to yourself, they don't care about what kind of pain that causes the patient or what kind of terror that causes the patient. They only care about how it looks, as if it were an aesthetic matter. And it's from that viewpoint that people prescribe shock treatment and prescribe psychiatric drugs. Now, we know that shock treatment causes brain damage. Paul Hoke, who used to be the commissioner of mental hygiene, said it's perfectly possible that shock treatment causes brain damage, but that doesn't matter because that may be the reason the patients get better. Shock treatment was invented in the 1930s by an Italian named Ugo Cerletti, and he mistakenly thought that schizophrenics didn't have epilepsy. So his idea was that if he could introduce epilepsy, the schizophrenia would go away. Well, of course, the reasoning was terribly faulty, and besides which, some schizophrenics do have epilepsy, so it has nothing to do with it whatsoever. However, it can frighten people into behaving in a socially acceptable way. And because I work with severely disturbed people, I know how they act in hospitals. And I can tell you that patients soon learn the name of the game. When a doctor says, "How are you? Are you still hearing those voices?" After a while, they learn to say, "Oh, no, I don't hear them anymore." Of course, they do, but they've learned that the doctor isn't interested in what those voices mean. Which brings us to the question of psychotherapy versus whatever kind of organic treatment you're going to give. Within the past 20 or 25 years, Freud's gotten a real bashing. And people have forgotten that the one important thing he discovered, about which there really isn't any controversy, is he's discovered there's such a thing as an unconscious. The unconscious can very much motivate our feelings and our behavior. The people who are giving these organic treatments don't care about the unconscious. They've even forgotten it exists. But by the way, Europeans have not. If you get sick in Europe, you're much more likely to get a good deal of psychotherapy and a great deal less of drugs. And in Sweden, they don't give shock treatment at all. There may be other Scandinavian countries don't either, but I know for sure they don't in Sweden. And that's because they have national health. There they can do the thing that is best for the patient. Here, as you pointed out, it's governed by money. The pharmaceutical companies make a great deal of money. The shock people have shares in the shock machine companies. So they're making a great deal of money. they don't have to, quote, bother to listen to patients. They don't want to try to understand what it is a patient is saying. They don't care anything about what kind of discomfort the patient has. Do you have any comment?
No, I'm listening because I like to hear where a person is going with their analysis and give them an opportunity to put it into a context.
Mm-hmm.
Too often in our society in interviews, it's little newsmaker blurbs with no context.
Yeah.
We're a nation of headlines and no text.
Mm-hmm.
So I want you to have a chance to roll it out and talk about the people who you know or have counseled who've had forced electroconvulsive therapy and what it's done to them.
At the very beginning of my training, there was a woman who was in our community who had so much shock treatment that she was absolutely untreatable anymore. There was nothing you can do. And I don't know where the line is exactly, but I do know that if you get to a certain number of shock treatments, that patient then no longer is able to be treated by psychotherapy. And they have this sort of zombie kind of attitude, the same way you do when you give too much drugs to a patient. They're in effect gone because you can't, brain damage does not undo itself. They're going to have brain damage until they're dead. And at least if you can gradually take somebody off drugs, that's most of it is undoable, though tardive dyskinesia is only recoverable about half the time. But with shock treatment, once the brain is damaged, it's damaged. And there's just so much you can help that person with. People say to me all the time, because I work with very seriously disturbed people, with people who are suicidal, people who are borderline, people who are very depressed, primarily people who are very guilt-ridden. Some of it is conscious and some of it is unconscious and has to be raised to the surface. Those kind of people, if you know what you're doing, can be treated. It has to be understood. It's pretty complicated because the unconscious is complicated. But it can be done. And I have had patients who were, you know, like next door to suicide. I had a patient who had 12 therapists before me, who now has a wonderful life with a husband and child, etc. I have another patient who was on drugs for 15 years, is now coming around very, very nicely. It's what's awful is when they're so terribly sick or so terribly drugged, they seem like they're not human. If the therapist hasn't had the experience of going through that process and knowing, having absolute conviction, that that person is just as human as everybody else, then you can go ahead and work with them and work through the obstacles, understand and believe that all of it has a meaning. The therapist may not know it immediately, but it means something to the patient, and eventually this is all going to become unraveled like a knot. It becomes all unraveled, and fascinating things come out of it. As you were saying earlier, the uniqueness of that particular human being will start to show. If the therapist is interested in hearing what apparently irrational material is, you know, it comes out as apparently irrational, it all turns out to make sense in its own unique way. If the therapist has the patient, the talent, and the courage to deal with it.
There's another aspect to this I would like for you to address, and that is, in a society that has prided itself in the rights of people to seek out their own life, providing they're not breaking the basic laws of society, that the autonomous person has always been identified as the unique person. And yet today, in the last 10 to 15 years, that whole principle of uniqueness has been usurped by a certain form of corporate uniformity. We see it in politics, where there's no longer a Democrat and a Republican. There's no longer a liberal and conservative. Everything has been brought to a homogenized, blanderdized process and pasteurized easily adaptable and completely accessible form for the masses. Well, what happens to the unique individual? How would they then be diagnosed and treated if they're not following the patterns of behavior of everyone else? And how many people would not have the patience even to sit with that person and ask them what is their perception on an issue?
Yes, I agree with you.
Instead, there's a knee-jerk reaction. Ah, you have this particular condition.
I agree with you absolutely. In that sense, I don't make the diagnosis. Once a woman who was about 300 pounds asked me what her diagnosis was, and I said, your diagnosis is that you're starving. And I knew that she was starving because she had to eat so much. Something in her was terribly, terribly hungry. That was the most meaningful diagnosis that I could give her. Now, she was starving not for food, but for something emotional. But she was, in fact, starving. That's the kind of diagnosis that I do. And that's why I say I'm interested in the kind of pain that particular patient brings to it. I think you're absolutely right about the loss of the uniqueness. I think 1984 is gradually coming, as we have heard it would. And it's going to mean a deprivation, certainly in art, very likely in the sciences, etc., that we will not tolerate people's differences. We immediately stamp them as abnormal and don't think about what happens to that person.
Take a look at the Cultural Revolution, where everything had to come from a central control in China for over 30 years. And look what happened to all of their art, their intellect, a whole antiquity of wonderful culture. Look what they did with it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it's really very sad, and we are losing it.
We're doing it, too.
The British had... have a different attitude. Certainly up until recently, they used to call what we call abnormal, they used to call eccentric. And they weren't immediately shipping somebody off to somebody to quote, help them. They had a tolerance for it. They were amused. They enjoyed it, or they didn't, as the case may be. But they didn't stamp people as something's the matter with you. I would much prefer to have any person in authority or not in authority say to someone, what is troubling you, or are you troubled? That's the interest that I have. I'm interested in the subjective and not the objective view. I really don't care what society thinks about my patients. I only care about their happiness.
Unfortunately, too many patients do care about what society thinks, which has gotten to be a patient.
Yeah. Well, the way I interpret that, when a patient worries about what society thinks, I generally say, I think that's your guilt operating. What you're thinking of as society is really your conscience that's very severe and very intolerant. Let's see if we can do something about that. Because you, patient, don't really know what society thinks, because society has diverse views. But let's see what you think society is and what you think that society is saying. And I can well imagine that that's probably causing you a lot of guilt, making you feel much less of yourself, lowering your self-esteem, and tying up your energy that ordinarily should go into your personality as you would like to express it. It's tying up energy, that energy that's going into this terribly severe conscience.
When you take a look around today, look at all the psychologists now who are making every effort, a concerted, organized effort, to be given the right to prescribe medications.
I know, it's terrible. And what we're saying to the world that way is, oh, we're too stupid to help these people psychotherapeutically. We kind of give them drugs because we really don't know the proper way to help them. I don't understand them. I can tell you that, Gary, because it's like they're putting themselves down. That's what they're saying. They're saying we're too dumb to help anybody, because that's what drugs means, and that's what shock means, is The concepts that are involved in helping somebody psychotherapeutically are too complicated for us to understand. We have to do these simple things like write out a prescription or press the button in a shock machine. And all the psychotherapeutic understanding that has been going on since 1900 and went right up to the middle 1950s, all that is getting lost, Gary. It's dreadful. I keep thinking about internet, and we have so many wonderful methods of communication. All that knowledge is being lost. So many people contributed to it, not just Freud, and not just the prominent analysts that one hears about, but all the minor people that wrote this paper or that paper, who didn't become famous, but had a contribution to make to the field. All that knowledge is being lost that could help so many people.
It was about 15 years ago that a close friend called me one day. It was on a Sunday, and I was just finishing a run. Said, can you take a ride up with me to Connecticut? I'd like for you to see my sister. So I said, all right. So I rode up, and she was in a private sanitarium. And it was one of these very expensive places, and the family was not a wealthy family. And they had really stretched all their resources because they didn't want to dump their daughter into a state institution. But she had been through 13 psychologists, 3 psychiatrists, and was on multiple medications. And she was told that she had multiple personality disorder, and she was manic, and she was bipolar depressed. All that. I mean, in fact, she actually had contradictory diagnosis, mm-hmm. as I'm sure you've seen that also.
Sure.
And that really kind of freaks people. Well, you mean you've got two opposite diagnoses that could not exist, but that doesn't seem to confuse anyone who's making the diagnosis. So anyhow, I had last seen her about a year before. In fact, it was at one of our gatherings that I used to do on the Catskills at Grossinger's, and I remember at the time sitting with her and her family, and she was talking about going to Cornell University and then MIT. And I was thinking at the time, I actually told her sister, I said, I think that you should have a conversation with her to let her know the world's a little different place than what your family has led her to believe. She's very bright, and she's going to run into a buzzsaw reality, and she's not going to be prepared for it. The tools that she's been given will not open any of the doors that she needs to get through for the happiness and creativity that's uniquely hers. And they kind of poo-hooed it, and that was it. Here she is. She had gone from, she's 5'4", weighed about 109 pounds. She was 245 pounds. That's 245 pounds. In fact, she had tried earlier that year, I was told, to cut her fat off with some scissors. And that's how much into self-loathing she was. So I walk in, and oh, God, the environment there was absolutely moribund. And she's sitting there, and she's very surprised to see me. And I asked her sister to wait in the other room, and I walked over, and I said, hi. She said, hi. I said, well, I'll tell you this. Right now, you are the luckiest woman I know. There's this kind of everyone else around, there were other parents of kids, and everybody kind of stopped, and they're looking at me. And she looks up, and she just, her face just, the veins on the side of her head started to pulse, and she went into a rage, and she got up, and she was screaming and yelling, and there was a ashtray, and she threw the ashtray down on the floor, and some attendants started to come in, and I just, no, I said, let her vent a little bit. And so she was really going off, and she went on and on and on about how my life is destroyed, all men, I hate you, I hate everyone, you're a liar, you're a fraud, you told me this about vegetarianism, and everybody, I can't trust anybody. And I said, I still repeat it. Listen to what I'm saying. You are the luckiest person I know at this moment as a woman. Finally, after about 5 minutes, she calmed down, and I said, let me explain. All the women I know, Cindy, virtually every woman, from co-workers who are psychologists to the people all the people I work with, They are trying to make sense of the world that they've been given, and their ideals, their dreams, don't always fit into the world we live in. And so they have questions they cannot find answers for. They're struggling. Many of the women I know are so insecure on an emotional level, though very most of the people, women I know and her friends, are very secure intellectually or in their career, but they're emotionally, they're like underdeveloped, because they were conditioned to believe that you're only somebody if you have a man in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You're only somebody if somebody loves you.
Yeah.
And so no matter how much they've done in one part of their life, they feel so undercompensated in another. And so they've worked on what they considered essential for their image, essential for their self-esteem, but not succeeded with their security. And if you start off trying to be secure because you're insecure, virtually every choice you make will be based upon insecurity. The results are going to be self-evident. You're going to end up just as insecure, even when you think you're secure, because you're never going to be really confident that you're enough to be enough in your own life. You're only going to be enough if you're someone else's enough in their life.
Yeah.
And therefore, your self-esteem comes through the acknowledgement someone else loves you enough that you should be lovable. Therefore, you exist because someone cares about you and identifies you. I said, well, Cindy, when you went off to school, you were told that your teacher would respect your mind. That you even were bragging to me that when you were going to go to MIT, that it was a great place to go to, and that all these geniuses were there. Now, what happened? Now you're telling me that the first time you went on a date, the guy wanted to get in your pants and not in your brain. All right?
Yeah.
And I said, well, so he was looking down and you were telling him to look up, you got angry. Now you start condemning him and men for that. Then your professor, when you were a vegetarian, he made fun of you, and the other students did too, in Cornell, in your nutrition department, because you thought that he should be more idealistic, and you got angry because you were rejected by other people who were eating the meat and not caring, even though it was nutrition. And then you went to MIT, and you tell me that you ran into all these people that all they cared about was making millions of dollars, making their deals, and winning Nobel Prizes, and they really didn't care about the ethics of what they were doing. So you saw a lack of ethics at MIT.
Yeah.
Well, that's the real world, all right? You have people who don't have ethics, and you just didn't run into the people who did. And you didn't run into the guy who would look at your brain before your pants, and you didn't talk with a professor who did respect or would respect your choices. So you suddenly have condemned all these people for the choices that you found yourself in, and then you responded by rejecting everything you'd been believed, because now everything you were taught by your parents and other people, you said were lies. And so now you believe in nothing. And because you believe in nothing, you're lucky. Because the person who believes in nothing has nothing to lose and detach from, because they've already ripped their reality off. But I said, the difference is that instead of constructively deconstructing what you no longer want to believe in, so you can constructively reconstruct the life that you choose for yourself, you ripped your reality off like ripping your skin off alive.
Yeah.
And you've gone through this pain. So you're here in this institution, you're overweight, because you have so rejected, you have nothing to believe in. And because you believe in nothing, you don't believe in yourself. And because you don't believe in yourself, you're willing to let yourself go like this. I said, you could walk out of here tomorrow if you accept that from now on, do not go to your parents or me or anybody else or professors. Create a reality that's based upon what you see the world to be and what you want yourself to be within that world, and then seek out those people who will complement that reality. They exist. And
yes.
You know that the next day she had a session with her counselor and with the psychiatrist, and the day after she was released.
Wow.
She is a completely healthy, balanced person. Her parents hate me. Her sister hates me. Oh, God, do they hate me. I think of my face with a dartboard. I should go into business selling that. Why? Because we want our daughter back the way she was. And I said, hold on.
That's right. Absolutely.
You know, you tried to create a world that didn't exist for your daughter. And when she woke up one day and saw that it wasn't a real world, she rejected everything in that world and herself in the process. Now she's created, she went to live on a kibbutz in Israel. She had a great time there. She learned. She would never have done that before.
Yeah.
She started to use skills and attitudes other than what she had. And I must say that today she's a remarkably balanced, happy person, and her family are miserable.
That's a wonderful story. It reminds me, sometimes I have patients who will say, "Val, I don't have any faith in you." I said, "That's marvelous. I don't want you to have faith in me. I'm not a religion. I want you to start trusting your own brain. You should never make the mistake of having faith in me. I can make a mistake at any time. Your job is to catch me. If you don't catch me in my mistakes, we'll both go down the wrong road. You've got to use your own brain. That's the only one that you can trust. That's the one that has your interests at heart more than any human being in the world."
We spend so much time being so concerned about what other people think of the judgments we make,
yes,
instead of looking at the consequences of our choices,
mm-hmm,
and changing them and honoring our real and true needs. How many kids out there today are being diagnosed because their needs were not what was important, but the parents or teachers or neurologist, psychiatrist needs exceeded the child's?
Absolutely, Gary. Absolutely. That's why that young woman turned out the way she was. Her parents needed her to be in that position.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for being on. And if people who want to get off neuroleptics and want not to take electroconvulsive therapy would like to reach out, how can they do that?
Yes, they certainly can.
And how do they do that?
Well, you've got to do it slowly in the first place. You've got to get off drugs slowly.
No. I'm not asking you. If they'd like to get it in touch with you,
with
how
me?
Can they do it?
My number is 718-592-2115. And I do have an office in New York, and I have an office in Queens. It's 718-592-2115.
Thank you very much for
being
on.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity, Gary.
Bye.
Bye.
That was Dr. Ravala Levin, L-E-V-I-N. I'm Gary Knoll. We've gone way past our time when we normally take a little station ID break. We're going to take that little break now and come right back, so please stay with us.